The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro. Part 1. Continued on cassette number 5, side 1. Irritated by Lyndon's posturing while holding court in Cecil Maddox's spare barber chair, several of the barbershop hangers-on decided to teach him a lesson. Knowing he would soon be coming, they smeared the seat of the chair with a fiery oil of mustard solution. It took only a moment to soak through the seat of Lyndon's pants, and he began first to squirm, and then yelling, "I'm burning, I'm burning!" He jumped out of the chair and started pulling his pants down. Recalls Crofts, "He was on fire, and he began to cry and holler. We were just big old kids. And he got his pants down, but he didn't take them completely off, and he ran out on the sidewalk." His father, whose little real estate office was also on Courthouse Square, heard him hollering out there and came running over. "And I never will forget. I always held that against Mr. Johnson." He took his belt off and he grabbed Lyndon by the hand, and one of the pants legs came off, and old Lyndon was going around there, and Mr. Johnson was holding him by one hand, and every so often, why, he'd pop him one across the seat with the belt. Maddox kept trying to tell Sam what happened, but Sam was so angry he wouldn't listen to him. When finally he did, he growled, "Well, there isn't any kid of mine going to run up and down the street with his bare butt hanging out." But spanking, or even a more emphatic form of corporal punishment, wasn't an unusual method of discipline in Johnson City. It was, in fact, standard and generally accepted as such. Lyndon's friend Bob Edwards, for example, says, "My daddy had a razor strop, and he never sharpened a razor on it. He wore it out on me. My daddy had a pair of cowboy boots, and he just wore them out on the instep, kicking my hiney. But he didn't do it out of meanness at all. My daddy was just trying to raise me the way his daddy raised him." And Sam Johnson's spankings were not unusually severe, quite the opposite, in fact. His car, his T-model Ford, had become the crux of his battle of wills with his son, who, against his repeated orders, would sneak it out of the Johnson barn at night after his parents were asleep, pushing it, often with his cousins Ava and Margaret and friends like Truman Fawcett, down the slope from the barn and out to the road, so that the noise from starting it wouldn't wake them up. Not infrequently, Sam would find out the next day what had happened. Once, Lyndon's cousin Ava recalls, he and his brother Tom came up to school, and they marched us right back over to Sam's house and out on that back porch and whipped our hineys with their razor strops. Truman, she says, had been real scared of Sam, but while the children were being marched along from school, Lyndon had whispered to us, "When he hits the first lick, scream like it's killing you, and he'll go easy." We all hollered and screamed, and afterwards Truman whispered, "He hardly hit me at all." That was the way Uncle Sam was, you know. We knew we could get away with murder. Uncle Sam would never really hit anyone. What was unusual was Lyndon's reaction to spankings. He would indeed scream. Scream so loudly and hysterically and piercingly that the screams would echo from one end of the quiet little town to the other. Spankings usually occurred around dinner time, when Sam would come home and be told about Lyndon's misdeeds by Grandmother Baines, or would see for himself that the chores hadn't been done again, and at dinner tables all over Johnson City, the conversation would suddenly be interrupted by those high-pitched yells, and people would say, "Sam's whipping Lyndon again." Johnson City's children knew Lyndon wasn't really being hurt, some, like Truman Fawcett, because they had once been present at a whipping, others because of physical evidence. When the boys went swimming in the Buff and the Purdon Alice, quite often little rear ends would bear strap marks, but Lyndon's never did. "I've seen him right after we had all heard him hollering and yelling, and he wasn't hurt at all. He didn't have a bruise spot on him," says one playmate. Some adults, like the Fawcetts, who lived diagonally across the street from the Johnsons and could observe them closely, knew this too. Their son Truman recalls that, "We'd be sitting at the table, and you could hear Lyndon hollering, and my parents would say, 'Oh, he's not hurting him.'" But not all adults understood, and many, ready to believe the worst of a man who drank, would tell biographers years later that Sam had been physically brutal to Lyndon. Sitting at their dinner tables, they would say, when they heard Lyndon's cries, "Sam's been drinking again, and he's beating his boy." And families who lived outside town, and hence were out of earshot, would be notified by old Ms. Spaulding, the telephone operator and a Baptist pillar, who would ring them up and report that Sam's killing that boy again. Lyndon, in fact, sometimes seemed to be going out of his way to reinforce the impression of his father's brutality. Once he ran out of the house to hide in a tree, and not only picked one right in Courthouse Square, where there were plenty of people around, but told them he was hiding from his father, acting terrified of Sam, begging them not to tell him where he was. "He always seemed to be trying to make people think that his father was mistreating him," Emmett Redford says. Did he want people to know that his mother was mistreating him, too? He was constantly borrowing food from other families, even when there was no shortage of food in his own home, recalls Barnwell. "We could hardly sit down to breakfast without Lyndon standing there with a cup, wanting to borrow a cup of flour or a cup of sugar or some coffee, and he made such a production out of it." He was continually going into the cafe, saying he was hungry and there wasn't anything to eat at home. And at least once this statement surprised two boys who were sitting, unseen by Lyndon, in the rear of the cafe, because they had just come from the Johnson home, where they and Lyndon had just finished eating. "I think probably he was hungry sometimes," says one of them, "but nowhere near as often as he said he was." Did he want people to know that his little sisters were mistreating him? He was constantly telling people how difficult it was for him to keep his house clean, particularly because his sisters wouldn't tidy up their bedroom, which was the largest room in the house. He said they had to have a big room because they'd never keep their clothes up off the floor, Ava recalls. He said he had to be after them all the time about how sloppy their room was, a statement which fell somewhat strangely on the ears of people who visited the Johnsons and who saw that Lyndon's room was by far the messiest of all. His reaction to injury, or imagined injury, at the hands of people outside his family was just as striking. Once, when he was only 10 years old, he and Clarence Redford had been fighting in the Redford front yard, rolling around in the dust, when Emmett Redford came along. "Because his father was dead," Emmett says, "I regarded myself as the protector of my brothers, and I yanked them apart and picked up this little shovel that was lying there and turned Lyndon over my knee and whacked him." "It was just an ordinary whack," Redford says, "and he was utterly astonished by its consequence. Lyndon let out a wail so loud I can still remember it. I can still see Lyndon. He was standing there. He had knee breeches on, and one leg was still up, but the other had fallen down around his ankle, and he was dirty, all covered with dust. And he stood there just screaming. You could hear him from one end of town to the other." As Lyndon grew older, the pattern of his behavior remained the same. After a male teacher spanked him and Luke Simpson for splashing water on girls in the schoolyard, Luke simply went back to playing. Lyndon raced home, crying, and burst into the house with a story of injustice and mistreatment that brought his father rushing to school for an angry confrontation with the teacher. Sometimes he would get into fights, just ordinary scuffling and wrestling matches. In the memory of friends, he always lost. He was physically quite uncoordinated. He threw a baseball like a girl, one classmate says. And as soon as he started losing, he would run home crying, a tall, skinny, awkward, teenaged boy with dusty cheeks and tears sliding down them, running through the streets of that quiet little town, sobbing loudly. "All anyone had to do was touch Lyndon, and he let out a wail you could hear all over town," Emmett Redford says. "He wanted attention. He wanted everyone to know someone had injured him. He wanted everyone to feel sorry for him." His demeanor was unusual in other ways, too. Except for the extent of its isolation, Johnson City was such a typical little Texas town. A courthouse, a little bank, a cotton gin with walls and roof of dingy tin, a water tank on rickety stilts, a cafe beside which, at a rickety wooden table, old men in faded shirts played dominoes to fill endless hours. A few stores, not so many as a dozen, lined up along a raised wooden sidewalk on whose edge younger men sat desultorily in a row, and beneath which dogs curled up and slept. straggling away from the courthouse and the street of stores, set down among vacant lots grown over sometimes with corn and sometimes with weeds, were small box-like houses behind picket fences. Through its dusty streets, occasional Model Ts chugged, and horses ambled, slowly pulling wooden wagons. But through those streets roamed one boy who wasn't typical at all. His clothes were different from the other boys' clothes, sometimes more elegant than their weekday overalls or knickers, or even than their Sunday suits, sometimes outlandishly elegant for such a town. By his senior year in high school, he had acquired not only the Palm Beach suit, but the only straw boater in Johnson City. On some occasions he wore blue jeans, but wore them tucked into brightly polished boots laced up to the knee, and the shirt he wore with them was a bright yellow silk crepe de chine, the neck of which he kept open to display either a turtleneck dickie or an ascot. To school, in whose graduation picture he is the only boy wearing a necktie, he sometimes wore, on black hair that was painstakingly pompadoured and waved, and sometimes slicked dramatically flat with stay-comb, a dapper English tweed cap. And sometimes his clothes were less elegant than other boys, so dirty and full of holes that even in comparison with them he looked shabby, shabbier than he had to, as if he were dressing for some deliberate effect. When he approached other boys, he would run up to them and begin to talk, gesturing violently with his arms, grasping their lapels, putting his arm around their shoulders, shoving his face close to theirs. He would hug them. This, in the memory of his childhood companions, was a conspicuous aspect of his behavior. "He was always laying all over my brothers," says Cynthia Crider. "The thing I remember about him was how he used to hang all over people, just hang all over them." But it was with adults, particularly women, the housewives of Johnson City, that his behavior was most striking. He would flatter women, play up to them. Recalls Stella Glidden. "Miss Stella," he would say to me, "I love your fried chicken better than anything in the whole wide world." And when she invited him to have some, he would say, "Why, Miss Stella, I thought you'd never ask." Say it with such expressiveness that the sentence became a byword in the Glidden household, so that whenever Mrs. Glidden asked her own four children if they would like something to eat, they would reply, "Why, Miss Stella, I thought you'd never ask." He would hug women and kiss them. Into the voice of Professor Emmett Redford, former president of the American Political Science Association, talking at the age of 72, comes, astonishingly, a definite note of jealousy when he says, "He'd put his arm around my mother and kiss her repeatedly. We used to ask, 'Mama, do you love Lyndon more than you do us?'" The other children were almost in awe of the way Lyndon acted with adults. "He would put me to shame," Redford says. "We and the Galloways were really close, but I would be too shy to go down and visit Grandma Galloway unless my mother took me. But he'd visit Grandma Galloway. He'd hug and kiss her. He'd hug and kiss all the mothers and the grandmothers, too. And all the women in town just loved him." But the children were in awe of the results he obtained. When Redford had caught him fighting in the dust of the Redford front yard with his brother and had spanked him, and Lyndon had let out the wail you could hear all over town, Redford's mother had appeared in the doorway, clad, he remembers, in a freshly starched white dress. She asked what had happened, and when told, said, "Well, Lyndon, I guess you'd better go home for the day." And, recalls Redford, "he stepped up to her, all dirty, and hugged her, and said, 'Oh, Miss Redford, we didn't mean any harm. Why don't you let us play?' And, of course, she did." She didn't even seem to mind, Redford adds, that the dust had rubbed off Lyndon's clothes onto her white dress. "My mother kept us on a pretty tight leash," he says, "but Lyndon could get whatever he wanted from her." Other children say he had the same effect on their parents. "Whenever we wanted to do something that we thought our folks wouldn't like, we'd let Lyndon do the asking," Bob Edwards says. "He could get them to let us do things that ordinarily they'd say no to." It wasn't just the flattery and the hugging that did it, say the children who grew up with him. It was the quality that underlay his technique. The precise nature of that quality they are unable to define, but they try, hard, to make a researcher understand that it was something very rare. You see, Truman Fawcett tries to explain, it didn't embarrass him to just go up and talk to anybody, not like I would be embarrassed, not like anyone would be embarrassed. And the way he did it was like nothing I've ever seen. I've never seen anyone else who could put it over. But Lyndon could put it over. He'd go up to the old ladies and call them Grandma, and they'd just love him for it. He called my Ma and Pa Cousin Melissa and Cousin Oscar, and they had been all prepared not to like him, and they just loved him, too. Lyndon Johnson was a very unusual boy. He wasn't unusual in smartness. He was smart, but he wasn't smart like Emmett Redford or like some others, either. He was unusual in this other thing. What was the reason that he acted this way? That he screamed and sobbed over spankings that didn't hurt, and cried hunger when he wasn't hungry, and made public complaint about the sloppiness of his sister's bedroom? What was the reason that he seemed almost to be trying to turn people against his own family? Was it, as Emmett Redford believes, because he wanted people to feel sorry for him, to pity him? And if so, why did he want pity? Was it because, for this boy who had, from his earliest years, needed attention, needed to be somebody, needed to stand out, needed public distinction, for this boy who was now a member of an undistinguished, poor family, and was himself awkward in athletics and only average in schoolwork, pity was now the only distinction possible? Was it something deeper? He was the same boy, after all, who had had to ride on the front of the donkey, who had had to be at the head of the ring, who had taken his ball and gone home if he couldn't pitch, who had needed not only attention but respect, deference, who had needed to lead, to dominate. When his parents had been respected, he had been unusually close to them, especially to the father who was a leader. He had dressed like his father, talked like his father, campaigned with his father, and wished the campaigning could go on forever. Did he now feel that his father, by his failure, had betrayed him? Did he act the way he did because now that his parents were looked down on, he wanted to show that he was different from them, better than them? What was the reason for the intensity, the feverishness of the way he acted, the way he worked so frantically to convince people he was right in every argument, worked so frantically to ingratiate himself with them, not with some of them, but with all, down to the crustiest, most unapproachable old matriarch? What was the reason that, as Clayton Stribling put it, the more someone disliked him, the harder he tried to be his friend? Try by fawning, by smiling, by wheedling, by hugging, by abasing himself, by doing whatever he had to do until he succeeded. What was the reason that he didn't only want his way with people, adults as well as children, not only his friends but their mothers as well, but had to have his way? Was it because of the depth of his shame? Because, as Wilma Fawcett speculates, he was embarrassed because of his father, and because of the depth of his insecurity, because he had been yanked, in an instant it must have seemed, so rapid was his father's fall, from security into an insecurity that included continual worry about whether the very house he lived in was going to be taken away from him? Because his family had been yanked in an instant, not just out of public respect, but into something close to contempt? Because where once he himself had been able to charge more in stores than other children, now he could charge nothing at all and had to stand watching while his friends put purchases on their parents' accounts? Lyndon Johnson understood the transformation in his father's fortunes quite clearly. "We had great ups and downs in our family," he would recall. "One year things would go just right. We'd all be riding high in Johnson City terms, so high, in fact, that on a scale of A to F, we'd be up there with the A's. But then 2 years later, we'd lose it all. We had dropped to the bottom of the heap." Was it, in short, the rapidity of the change in his life, the violence with which he was hurled from one extreme to the other, that made him act the way he did? Or was it something deeper, something not just in his circumstances, but in his nature? Did he act this way because there was something in him, born in him, bred in him, that demanded of him that he be in the A's, that demanded of him, as it had demanded of his father, of his grandfather, of all that mighty Bunton line, that they be in the forefront? Lyndon Johnson's father had not, after all, been poor when little Lyndon let Harold Withers pop his ears for nickels, no matter how much it hurt. Lyndon Johnson's father had not been despised when Lyndon had hidden in the haystack to get attention, written his name on the blackboard in capital letters, taken his ball and gone home, had displayed so strong a desire to be somebody, to lead. Whatever it was that made Lyndon Johnson act the way he acted, that made him try to dominate people, to get them to defer to his opinion, to get his way with them by any and every means, heredity as well as humiliation plays a role in the explanation. The transformation in his family's fortunes merely emphasized these needs in his temperament. By making it harder, almost impossibly hard, for him to satisfy them, had given his efforts to satisfy them that feverish, almost frantic quality. His family's fall had added a powerful dose of insecurity and humiliation to the already powerful inherited strain that formed the base of the complex mixture that was Lyndon Johnson. In many ways, it was not what he did that made Lyndon Johnson so unusual, but the intensity with which he did it. What was it he wanted? Attention? Sympathy? Respect? Dominance? Whatever it was, he was desperate to have it. Yet his desperation couldn't get for him whatever it was he wanted. He could make adults, particularly women, pity him, sympathize with him, let him have his way, in large part because he was desperate, and they realized it. Ask the women who were fondest of the gangling, awkward youth why they treated him so gently, and they all reply in almost the same words, "I felt sorry for him." But he could not make them stop thinking of him as a Johnson. And in a small town like Johnson City, family was the significant identification. Moreover, his was a family that had, in Hill Country terms, been steeped in scandal. 50 years before, the original Johnson brothers had gone broke and left a trail of debts across the Hill Country. Now, in the hard and uncharitable opinion of the Hill Country, history was being repeated by another pair of Johnson brothers named Sam and Tom. Not so much by Tom, perhaps, although he was unsuccessful in business and going broke, but certainly by Sam, who owed everyone in town, and plenty of people in other towns besides. Truman Fawcett clearly remembers sitting on a porch with his uncle, Frank Fawcett, while Lyndon Johnson walked by. His uncle's eyes followed Lyndon down the street, and then he said, in a tone of flat finality, "He'll never amount to anything, too much like Sam." Lyndon may not have wanted to be thought of as Sam Johnson's son, may have been desperate not to be thought of as Sam Johnson's son, but that was how he was thought of. And if he had any doubts that this was so, they must have been erased shortly after his graduation from high school. All during the spring of 1924, Lyndon and his classmate Kitty Clyde Ross were, their friends said, in love. It was a spring of picnics beside the Purdon Alice and ice cream and cake socials given by Johnson City women's clubs in honor of the 6-member graduating class. And Lyndon and Kitty Clyde, a bright, pretty girl, sat together at all of them. In class, they passed notes, arranging to meet after school, and at snap parties, they tried to kiss only each other. When Lyndon dropped her off at her house after an evening social, she would lean out her window and watch to make sure that he went straight home and didn't talk to any other girl. Their classmates wondered if they would get married someday, although Lyndon wouldn't be 16 until August. He was, the record reported, believed to be the youngest graduate of the school. Kitty Clyde was a year older, and Johnson City girls married young. But Kitty Clyde's father was E.P. Ross, the richest man in town. He was a merchant. The record's front page often carried a large ad for Ross's general merchandising store. One of the merchants who was writing "please" on the bills he sent to Sam Johnson every month. He was, moreover, a pillar of the Methodist Church and strong for prohibition. And his views of the Johnson clan were no secret. He was known to feel that it had been very lucky for his wife, the former Mabel Chapman, that 20 years before her family had forbidden her to marry Sam Johnson, and that she had married E.P. Ross instead. When, shortly after graduation, the principal of Johnson City High School, Arthur K. Krause, asked Ross's permission to court Kitty Clyde, he gave it, encouraged the courtship, in fact, though Krause was almost 30. It was unusual in those days for a girl to go with someone so much older, Ava says, but the Rosses were so afraid Kitty Clyde was going to marry Lyndon that they were glad for her to go with anybody just to break her up with him. Kitty Clyde's parents, in fact, ordered her not to spend time with Lyndon, and to make sure she didn't have much time to spend. Not that she would have disobeyed them, Ava says. In those days, in towns like Johnson City, girls didn't disobey their parents. Kraus was frequently invited for dinner at the Ross home. After dinner, Kitty Clyde and Kraus would go for a drive. In the Ross car, a fancy new Ford sedan, with Mr. and Mrs. Ross along as chaperones. Often in the evenings, Lyndon would be talking or playing with friends in Courthouse Square. He would see the Ross car pass by. His cousins, Ava and Margaret, saw how he felt then. Trying to cheer him up, the vivacious Margaret made up a new verse to a popular tune, to mock the fact that Kraus couldn't see Kitty Clyde without her mother along, and would sing it after the Ross car had passed. I don't like the kind of man does his lovin' in a Ford sedan, 'cause you gotta see Mama every night, or you can't see Baby at all. Quiet, shy Ava never said anything to Lyndon, but sometimes after she had gone home, she would, she says, cry for him. It was so unfair, she says. It, the Ross's attitude, didn't have anything to do with Lyndon. He had never done anything wrong. It was because they thought Lyndon was going to be just like Sam. And what made it even sadder was that it was history repeating itself. Sam hadn't been allowed to marry Kitty Clyde's mother, and now Sam's son wasn't allowed to marry Kitty Clyde. I was a Johnson, and it was very unfair to the Johnsons, and it was very unfair to Lyndon. And I saw how it made Lyndon feel when that big car drove by with Kitty Clyde in it with another man, and I cried for him. Once, Ava says, Lyndon told her and Margaret that he was working up his nerve to ask Kitty Clyde for a date anyway. He guessed, he said, that he would ask her to go with him to the annual Johnson City-Fredericksburg baseball game and picnic. Kitty Clyde said she'd have to ask her parents. She came back and said she wouldn't be able to go. After that, Lyndon never asked her again. Sometime thereafter, Kitty Clyde and Kraus broke up. Her father thereupon sent her to the University of Texas, insisting she live in the Masonic dormitory, whose tenants were not allowed to have dates. She returned to Johnson City after college, but never dated Lyndon again, and eventually married another local boy, who her father thought had good prospects, but who worked in the Ross store until it was sold. When Lyndon became president, he invited Kitty Clyde and her husband to Washington and took them for a flight on Air Force One. What was it like to grow up in Johnson City? On the surface, life was idyllic as the scenery in which the town was set, those rolling hills and that sapphire sky. Listening to the friends of Lyndon Johnson's youth who stayed in Johnson City, Texas, who lived out their lives there, is like reading Penrod and Sam. Their description is of picnicking and Kodaking, taking snapshots with Brownie cameras by the Purton Alice, of long lazy days sitting by the river with a cane fishing pole, of swimming in that clear icy water, of playing croquet on Doc Barnwell's front lawn, of baseball outings when all the kids in town would pile onto a flatbed truck and drive to play a team from Blanco or Marble Falls, of chatting quietly with friends in Courthouse Square as a beautiful hill country sunset faded in the wide sky and twilight fell, of gentle maturing in a quiet, serene, beautiful little town. The children who stayed speak of the friendliness of the hill country, where, as a local saying went, they know when you're sick and care when you die. More than one says flatly, "There's no place else on earth that I would rather live." More than one says of growing up there, "It was heaven." But listening to the friends of Lyndon Johnson's youth who didn't stay, to those who, like Lyndon Johnson, left Johnson City, the picture takes on darker shadows. Poverty shadows the picture. Cash money was in such short supply that Joe Crider once rode a horse 20 miles across the hills at a slow walk, gingerly holding several dozen eggs, in order to sell them, for a nickel a dozen, in Marble Falls. Dolls were a luxury in Johnson City. Joe's daughter Cynthia had only one. It had a china head on which, every Christmas, my mother would put a new body. And many Johnson City girls made do with corn cobs wrapped in scraps of cloth. Baseballs were a luxury. Lyndon's threat to take his ball and go home was effective because sometimes his was the only ball. After Sam Johnson went broke, sometimes there was none. When there was a ball, it was usually ragged. When someone had one, boy, we played with it until it just fell apart, Bob Edwards says. Books, even school books, were a luxury. Ragged, too, because they were handed down from one class to another. There were never enough to go around. You just can't imagine how poor people in Johnson City were, says Cynthia Crider, whose brothers were Lyndon's closest friends. You just can't imagine how little we had. Sometimes the Criders couldn't buy enough food for their cattle and goats. They would feed them on prickly pear cactus, from which they had burned off the nettles. Sometimes they couldn't buy enough food for their children. Then the entire dinner would consist of Crider gravy, which was nothing but flour and milk flavored with bacon drippings on top of bread. For Christmas decorations, the Criders made paper chains out of pages from Big Chief writing pads and colored them with Crayola crayons, and they glued the pages together with the sticky white of eggs because they couldn't afford a bottle of glue. As dark as the poverty was the consciousness of poverty. The children of Johnson City were not only poor, they felt poor. I sure did, says Louise Casperus, whose father, the town blacksmith, made 15 cents for shoeing a horse, a 3-hour job. Many times I'd go to the store with just a dollar to spend. That wasn't enough, not to buy food for a whole family. But a lot of times that's all I'd have. I still remember going into the store with just that $1. They realized, moreover, not only that they were poor, but that they were getting poorer. The Depression came early to farmers, and nowhere did it come earlier than in the hill country. 1924 and 1925 were years as bad as anyone could remember. The drought in 1925 was so bad that on the Dollahite farm, John Dollahite recalls, we made no crops at all. And in the hill country, hard times had a special significance for teenagers. When farmers' crops didn't bring them enough cash money to pay their taxes and mortgage, they had no choice but to take the step which many of them had vowed never to take, to send their children to work off the farm, earning cash wages, pitifully small though they were, doing day labor for other farmers. Such labor was brutal in the burning hill country sun. Cotton, as William Humphrey has written, is a man-killing crop. Plowing it, pointing and holding the plow blade in the rocky ground, while the horse or the mule strains at the traces, is hard. Thinning it, chopping out every other plant with a hoe, is hard. And when picking time comes, you strap on knee pads and a long sack of cotton duck, and you are in the field stooping and crawling and pulling that sack after you before daybreak, out until dark beneath a searing sun. After just one day of it, you cannot straighten your back at night to lie in bed, and your hands, even your work-hardened hands, are raw and bleeding from the sharp-pointed hulls. Not only men and women were working in the hill country in 1924 and 25. Teenage boys and girls were out in the fields, too, and even the girls had to work like men. The picture is shadowed not only by poverty, but by fear. Johnson City teenagers understood why they had to work. Looking back now on those days, it seems as if everyone, just about, was worried about meeting the payments on their mortgage, one says. I know we sure were. Not having a home, being forced to take your possessions and move, to get into your rickety car and drive off, God knows where, with almost no money in your pocket, that was the abyss. And in 1924 and 25, many hill country families were on the very edge of that abyss, and their children knew it. We had a sense of insecurity, Emmett Redford says, with very few exceptions, very few. A sense of insecurity hung over everyone around there. Poverty, fear, and a sense of hopelessness, for there seemed no way out of the poverty. A dentist couldn't make money in Johnson City. The only dentist had long since left. The town's dental needs were met by a traveling dentist who came through every few months. A doctor couldn't make money. Doc Barnwell was always complaining that half the town is walking around and I haven't been paid for delivering them yet. A lawyer couldn't make money. As for men who sold insurance or real estate, I used to wonder, Redford says, how much real estate could you sell in that country? Most of the people in the hill country made their living from the land, and those teenagers who thought about the land understood that, as Redford says, you go 10-15 miles east of Austin and you begin to see black soil and prosperous cotton farms and big houses on the farms. But there was no black soil around us, and there were no big houses. I had a feeling even as a boy. In this town, there were no opportunities. When, moreover, Johnson City teenagers used the phrase, no opportunities, they were talking about more than career opportunities. The lack of money was not the lack they felt most. The roar of the 20s was only the faintest of echoes in those vast and empty hills, a mocking echo to hill country farmers who read of Coolidge prosperity and the reduction in the work week to 48 hours and the bright new world of mass leisure, while they themselves were still working the 7-day-a-week, dawn-to-dark schedule their fathers and grandfathers had worked. A mocking echo to hill country housewives who read of the myriad new labor-saving devices, washing machines, electric irons, vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, that had freed the housewife. Even if they had been able to afford such devices, they would not have been able to switch them on, since the hill country was still without electricity. America, confident, cocky, bull market, hip flask, jazz age America, was changing in the 20s, changing with furious and exciting speed. Even much of Texas, still geographically isolated from the rest of the country, was changing, as oil made a boom town out of Beaumont and war-born industries stayed on to turn Houston and Dallas and even Austin into fast-growing cities. But little of the excitement managed to penetrate those hills. It was the age of radio. Even the poor had radio. Forests of antennas had sprung up on tenement house roofs. Even the rural poor had radio, which was ending the isolation of many rural areas by, in the words of historian David A. Shannon, bringing the world not only to the middle-class home, but to the tar-paper shack with an immediacy never before known. By the middle of the decade, few people were out of earshot of the loudspeaker. But the hill country did not have radio. With the exception of a few crystal sets, whose operators sat hunched over the needle they kept maneuvering to bring into their earphones sounds from New York almost 2,000 miles away, no one in the hill country heard the voice which, during the Democratic National Convention of 1924, became familiar to the rest of America as it bellowed over and over, Alabama, 24 votes for Underwood! It was the age of movies. By the time the boys came trooping home from the war in 1919, Shannon says, the movie had set up its flickering screen in every crossroads village. But the man who wrote that had never headed west out of Austin. Movies in Johnson City, shown on the whitewashed wall of the second floor of Harold Withers' Opera House, as Harold Jr. provided background music by playing the same scratchy phonograph record over and over, were shown very infrequently. People couldn't afford to pay the 15-cent admission charge too often. To the extent that the 1920s were the age of radio and the movies, and of country clubs, golf, joyriding, and cheek-to-cheek dancing, of a new mass culture, the hill country was not a part of the 1920s. And the children of the hill country knew it. Not only were they not current on events, they knew they weren't current, and they were ashamed. During Lyndon Johnson's high school years, the school's students held a debate on the League of Nations. They sent away to the University of Texas Extension Service for articles and studied them, and the students felt they understood the subject. But they recall it was the only international or national subject they understood. You know, you couldn't get any information out here, even if you wanted it, Louise Casperis says. In bad weather, even the newspaper wouldn't come in, maybe for a week at a time. We were completely cut off out here. We knew about the League, but that was all we knew about. That was the pathetic thing. Truman Fawcett remembers that during the years when Sam Johnson was still a politician, Lyndon would bring posters of the Democratic candidates for governor and other statewide offices around to shops and ask shop owners for permission to put them in the window. "And we had never even heard of most of them," Fawcett says. "Their names were names we had never even heard." Says Louise Casperus, "You just would hardly understand the situation back there that we grew up in, because, you know, we had no radio, no newspapers to amount to anything, no nothing. We were just what you would call back in the woods compared to the rest of the world." They felt poor, they felt back in the woods, and they felt bored. "It was a rather drab little city," Lyndon Johnson's sister Rebecca says. Says Emmett Redford, "About all there was out there was three fundamentalist churches, a school with six rooms in it, and the courthouse. Occasionally there would be a case for the Justice of the Peace Court, which handled traffic violations and minor offenses. And three or four times a year the district court, which handled the big cases then, would come into town and would meet for a week, and the town would fill up with visiting lawyers, and the district attorney and the district judge would come in. And occasionally drummers would come in, or outside preachers for revival meetings at the churches, and in political campaigns candidates for office would come through. Not too often, though. Aside from that, the contact with the outside world was very limited. There was no movie, no form of paid entertainment whatsoever. My God, there wasn't even a cafe half the time. If you were a kid, you went to school 5 days a week. On Saturdays, everybody comes into town. The kids play with each other. On Sundays, you go to church. Now, that was about the round of life." There seemed no way out of that round. Once there had been excitement in Blanco County, but that excitement had ended when the last Comanche had faded away to the north. In the half-century since then, the round of life had changed hardly at all. If a teenager wanted to see what lay ahead of him, all he had to do was look across Courthouse Square at the old men, once youths who had stood chatting in the square as they themselves were doing now, who appeared promptly at noon every day — they had, after all, nothing else to do — and sat playing dominoes for matchsticks until it became too dark to play anymore. And what of the unusual teenager, the one more interested in the outside world, more intellectually active, more ambitious, or perhaps simply more restless than the other teenagers in Johnson City? Few Johnson City teenagers, no more than a handful really, graduated even from the 11th grade, which was the last grade in its high school. Fewer still went off to college. And of those who went to college, almost none came back to their hometown. "So what was left in Johnson City," says one who did come back, "were people who didn't have much education and weren't much interested in current events or in the larger world. It wasn't just that we didn't have anything to read, we didn't have anyone to talk to." And what specifically of the one teenager most interested in the outside world? The teenager who put up the political posters? How did he feel about living out his life in the Johnson City round? Was that last high school spring so idyllic on the surface, an idol for him? The contemporary most like Lyndon Johnson, in the opinion of Johnson City residents, was a youth 3 years older, Emmett Redford. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.